From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Lisa Reisman is my guest. Her memoir, 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours, is a great book that you should read. So I invited her to talk about it. Lisa Reisman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So when your story begins, you're a lawyer in New York, but you decide to quit. Is that right?
That's correct. I was a lawyer in New York for 4 years, and I just began to get gradually sort of disillusioned with the life and decided sometime in 1998 that I wanted to do something different.
So even though you went to law school and went to all that trouble to become a lawyer, you were ready to turn your back on it?
I was. It wasn't something that I could foresee myself doing forever, so I thought it was high time that I got out and figured out what to do next.
Well, before we move on and find out what you did next, what was the worst thing about being a New York lawyer? I mean, I would think it'd be cool. You must have a nice view, and, you know, that's what we see on TV, the high-powered lawyer in New York.
And that was true in the beginning. I was pretty dazzled by it. I was felt very good about myself and very important in my business suit and my 32nd floor office and my secretary and the Lincoln Town Cars home. It just got, the hours began to mount, and I just felt that I was sort of spending my life in this airless building. And even though I was working with really smart people, I sort of figured out that I was not so much meant to be a lawyer. My mind wasn't configured to be a lawyer as much as other lawyers. And what the only thing that I could do really well was write briefs, write really persuasive briefs and motions. And that's basically how I stayed employed.
All right. So you decided to turn your back on the law, and you were going to buy a little red Corvette or something?
Right. Yeah. Well, my plan was I had been sort of going through, I had gone to college and then graduate school and then law school, and then I just wanted to do something completely off the well traveled path. So my plan was to buy a lipstick red convertible and drive around the country until I decided what to do next. I figured it would come to me.
But fate intervened.
But,
yes, you suddenly. Well, I mean, did you have any warning about what was about to happen, or it just happened all of a sudden?
I had no warning. I had given notice in that summer of 1998, probably sometime in July. Given 6 weeks notice, and I had the Friday before my final week of work, I was preparing for a conference to settle a case before it went to trial, and then the next morning, a Saturday morning, I went for a 5-mile run through Riverside Park. I was living on the west side of Manhattan, and it was a sweltering day, and I got back to my apartment, and I called my sister, or my sister called me. Neither of us can remember, but whatever happened, I told her I couldn't talk. I was too tired. I'd call her when I got up. And then I took a nap, and I didn't get up for 46 hours.
Proving my point that exercise is very bad for you.
Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, so
quite to the contrary, as it turns out, yeah.
So you it turned out that you had cancer.
It did. Well, so what happened was after I hung up the phone, I went to take a nap, and at some point after my head hit the pillow, I suffered a massive seizure. And because there had been no warning signs, as I mentioned, no one really knew what was going on. All they knew is that I wasn't answering my phone. I mean, I was 32 years old. I could, you know, I was running 5 miles pretty much a couple times a week, and there was no reason to think that anything was wrong with me. And so basically, my sister sensed something was wrong when I didn't call through that Saturday, because that was uncharacteristic of me. On Sunday morning, she called my father, and together they called my landlord, he was away for the week. My super didn't have a copy of the keys. They called around to all the ERs in New York City. I hadn't been admitted to any of them, and the NYPD refused to break into my apartment because I hadn't been missing for 72 hours, and I was neither under 18 or over 70. So what happened was, still, it was Sunday afternoon. I still wasn't answering my phone. They called around to my friends. The only set of keys that anyone knew about were in my sister's possession, and she was in Baltimore. So they kept holding out hope that I would just show up for work on Monday morning with a perfectly viable excuse, but they didn't want to take any chances. So early Monday morning, my sister and her husband went to the Baltimore train station with a copy of my keys, and they put them on the package express. So all through Monday morning, it was going through, Delaware, Trenton, Newark, and then New York. And my stepmother, who was working at the UN at the time, picked up the keys, hailed a taxi, and rushed to my 82nd Street apartment, where she found me on the floor of my bedroom, unconscious, near death. So she had me rushed to the hospital. An MRI at the hospital showed a mass in the right frontal lobe of my brain. Doctors told my family it appeared benign, but they couldn't know for sure until it was surgically removed. That happened 3 days later at Memorial Sloan Kettering, an 8-hour surgery. And 3 days after that, we met with the neurosurgeon and learned that it was, in fact, a glioblastoma multiforme, which is the most lethal and the most ruthless and the most aggressive form of brain cancer.
Well, back up just a little bit. So when your stepmother came to your home, did you wake up or not?
I didn't. I was unconscious. I didn't actually wake up. I don't know. I probably woke up on Tuesday. And that's when I heard that I had a tumor in my brain. That was the first thing I heard.
Yeah. And you had had no symptoms, no inkling, nothing had ever happened that would lead you to, or were there things that the doctors told you later, you know, if you had noticed this or that?
You know what? I wish there had been, because it's very frustrating. But I would get headaches from time to time and pop some Advil, but I mean, nothing that I can really know. I mean, that's sort of the disturbing part of it. And, yeah, I just, I was under a lot of stress just because there were a lot of demands made upon an associate in a high-powered law firm. But, and I was working crazy hours, of course, and I probably wasn't as healthy as I could be, but I was pretty fit. I mean, I was probably not eating as healthy as I could be, but I was pretty fit. So, no warning signs, no.
Now, I don't want to, you know, put any spoilers on your book, but mm-hmm. Did you survive? That's what I want to know.
No, in fact, I didn't.
That's the sad
why
part.
The book is doing so well. That's why the book is 7 pages long. Yeah.
So you got this devastating news, and the news is even worse because they told you, well, that you avoided hearing the prognosis, right?
Yep. Right away, I heard. The words glioblastoma multiforme grade 4. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's something that's good.
No, it sounds bad.
So right away, I think I sensed that I didn't want to know, and I can't really explain why, except that I know myself, and I know that if I had learned the prognosis, which is commonly a survival rate of 12 to 18 months after diagnosis, I would have just started the countdown. It would have become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So in general, then, you know, just to generalize what happened to you, to others, do you think that it's a bad idea to tell people what doctors, I mean, considering that that didn't actually happen, that it's a bad idea to tell people how long they have to live?
I think it depends. I think if the patient wants to know, then yes, then by all means the doctor should tell them. But I think that the doctor should leave it up to the patients. And I think a lot of people would want to know. I just didn't. I think one of the ways I survived, and I want to emphasize, I really don't know why I'm still here, is with that sort of denial and just sort of putting on these blinders and trying to just see what I could do, whatever, just narrowly focus on whatever I could do to keep myself going and to survive.
You know, you're just feeding into all of these beliefs of mine. Exercise is bad for you. Denial is good for you. My guest is Lisa Riesman. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Lisa's book is called 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours. Why is it called 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours, Lisa Riesman?
Gary Shapiro, it's called 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours because the 5 months comprises the moment I learned that I had brain cancer in August 1998, to 5 months later when I learned that an MRI showed the cancer hadn't spread. And that didn't mean I was cured, didn't mean I would survive, but it was sort of shockingly good news. So the 5 months are basically the period of time when I didn't know if I would live or die. And 10 years after my diagnosis, I took on a triathlon sort of to mark the 10-year anniversary, and the triathlon itself, it took me 2 hours to complete. It was actually took me 1 hour and 48 minutes, but I didn't think that would sound good.
That's not as good a title.
No.
Well, so you 10 years later, you put yourself through this grueling
thing. Right, and so the idea of the book is that I think enduring a serious illness is much more of, I think it's what I said, it's an endurance test. It's much, I don't like the idea of the metaphor of a battle, because I think a battle connotes if you don't make it, you lost the battle. I think of it more as what you have to get through, what you have to endure every day after day. Like, you have to endure tests and treatments and trials, perhaps, and side effects and scans and MRIs and your fears and your guilt and your, you know, dealing with how much your family is worried and everything that you have to get through every day. And that's sort of, you have to endure all of that. So, and the reason that the book is structured around a triathlon is, obviously, the triathlon is also an endurance test. It's a physical endurance test, but it's also very much mental, because your mind and your body is screaming to give up at certain points of it, and you just have to keep going. So, sort of the refrain of the book is just keep going, I guess.
At some point in your book, you said that you learned to love your cancer.
Did I say that?
Yeah. Yes.
I did. Okay. I know now. Now I know. Okay. I did. You know why I said that? Because it really, how can I put this? It sort of made me realize what I had to do, and I never have been so disciplined in my life. And I had only one thing I had to do. I didn't have to worry about bills or work or satisfying a boss or all the mundane practicalities of daily life. I just had to figure out how to live each day so that I could live. So I hammered out this regimen for myself, and it was amazing, because I did everything that I love to do, which is to say, I played piano every day, and I told myself that was a way to rebuild my hand-eye coordination. I did crossword puzzles to keep my mind agile. I had always been a runner, so I that was my mindset, so I walked every day to the extent I was able. I did yoga. I meditated. I overhauled my diet. And I memorized poetry. And all of that, I would have these, I just remember walking one day to my yoga class. It was an October night. It was balmy outside. I was living with my mother. She lives on the ocean, and there was, I could hear the waves sort of crashing onto the shore, and I just felt this exhilaration of just, I don't know, I can't really explain it. And it was just, it was this purity of life, of just sort of thinking about doing everything I love to do. And I can't, that's, it's all the sort of, all the detritus is swept away, and you just think about what makes you go.
Do you think that stuck? I mean, do you think you love life more than you used to, or that maybe you would have if you hadn't been faced with this?
Some days. I mean, I think my book is very much a coming of age book, and in addition to a family memoir and obviously an illness memoir, and in the sense that it took me a long time to figure out, I don't know about the word happy, but just to figure out what would make me fulfilled. And that's the 10-year part of the title, that once you're sort of given the sort of tentative okay sign, it didn't mean I didn't have to undergo MRIs twice a year, but once I'm given that, you don't get a plaque, you don't get a medal, you don't get anything except a follow-up appointment. And then the 5 months I spent, I knew what I was going to do every single day. I knew I was actively fighting the cancer with my treatments. I knew I had to eat a certain way so that I was doing everything I could to keep my digestion, my body clean. After that, there's no roadmap. There's no roadmap to say, okay, what do you do now? And it's scarier still, because you're not really actively fighting the disease anymore, and that any time it can come back. So over the course of 10 years, I think I was trying to figure out how to validate my survival. And at the beginning, I thought I had to do something momentous and great and important and earth-changing. And, you know, eventually I realized I was trying to write my book. I tried to do these little jobs. And I just realized that I could just do something really small and seemingly insignificant and make an impact in my small corner of the world, which is what I do now, which is writing for my local newspaper, writing stories about small businesses that are struggling or people who are quietly making a difference in their own way. And that's pretty much the most gratifying work I can think of. So, yes, I am much more happy than I was when I was practicing law. But, I mean, the regular ups and downs, I don't think having brain cancer changed that sort of fact of life.
We're talking with Lisa Reisman. Her book is called 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. What about things like, you know, like Donald Trump and the Republicans and the Democrats? Are you sort of like less inclined to feel worried about things that are out of your control? Or are you like, oh, well, you know, I'm a survivor? I don't know. What? Tell me.
Well, no, I'm not less inclined. I'm following it with interest, but I'm not gonna get upset. I mean, I'm concerned, that's a good point. Yeah, I can't control any of that. I do follow it with interest, but I know I can't control it, so I'm not gonna curl up into a fetal position.
Doesn't keep you up at night.
No, absolutely not.
What about the Yankees? What are their chances?
Feeling good. Everyone's feeling good. It's spring training, Gary. How about your Giants?
The Giants are going to win the World Series this year, but that's...
I think they might. It's an even year.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, so you are now writing for your local paper. What about another book? Right. Now that you've written a book... And it's such a great, great book, and I want everybody to know that. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you.
Are you going to write another book? Because I'm waiting for one. Do you have to get cancer again in order to write another book?
I hope not. Well, I actually just spent a month at an artist colony, and I'm sort of working on two projects, one of which I'm very excited about, which is I'm following a minor league baseball player as he tries to make his way to the major leagues.
Wow.
So, and I've always wanted to do a book on the minor league baseball. So I have my subject, and I'm just sort of following him. And he had a tryout with the Texas Rangers in Arizona last Monday. So I don't think he made it because I haven't talked to him since then. But it's really exciting.
Well, that's an interesting idea for a book.
Yeah.
And the whole milieu of the minor leagues is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's life, man. Life.
And you wrote much of 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours at artist retreats, writers retreats.
That's true. I did, and then I mean I think I did a lot of the sort of the groundwork at artist colonies. I don't know if people know what they are, but that you go to these gorgeous places and they basically give you a room and three meals and say do whatever you want to do. And you're with artists, sculptors, composers, painters, fiction writers, and it's pretty great most of the time. So I did most of the groundwork for the book, but it took the triathlon to give me its structure. So I did most of that work when I'm where I live now.
And are you still active? And have you done other triathlons, or was that just a one-time deal?
Nope, I've done two other triathlons, and actually a great development, because since my book came out, I've gotten, and I never actually anticipated this, but I've gotten very involved with sort of, it's called the National Brain Tumor Society, and we do all these events to try to raise funds for people with brain tumors, and the great thing is that I never really talked about what I had gone through before my book came out, and now it's sort of incredible how much impact I realize I can have by just telling people I live this long. I don't think I did anything particularly special, but it's pretty nice to be able to help families and patients know that there's hope, and then further to help raise money so that no one has to go through what too many people do with my disease.
Well, when you said that you were avoiding your prognosis, when did you finally learn what it had been?
Probably about 5 years after I finally asked. And then when my book came out, I had to do an article about denial as luck would have it. And so I did some research, and I realized then that I was actually cured 7 years before. I was considered cured at the 10-year mark, which I didn't even know. I was very lucky, I should say, because I have a sister and a brother-in-law who are both doctors. So they were able to sort of buffer me from some of the more brutal realities, and I'm luckier than most because they have to educate themselves far more, and they have to sort of learn all the really scary side effects and prognoses and that kind of thing.
Now, I know that people can get your book from Amazon, but who published your book, and how can people get it?
A small publishing press called Outpost 19 in San Francisco published it, and so you can go to outpost19.com or amazon.com, and you can order my book.
And I hope they will. You have a website also?
I do. It's lisareismanauthor.com, R-E-I-S-M-A-N.
Well, I hope everybody will visit, and I hope that you write another book and come back and talk to us about it soon. This book is called 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours. The author, my guest, Lisa Reisman. Thanks so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, it's been a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you enjoyed the show and come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Lisa Reisman. Her book that I urge you to read is called 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours. It's available from Outpost 19 in San Francisco. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.